It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A lawsuit filed this month in Dane County Circuit Court seeks to overturn Wisconsin's congressional maps. The suit argues lawmakers drew the state's 8 congressional districts in an anti-competitive gerrymander to give incumbents a competitive advantage.
Late last month, the Wisconsin Supreme Court declined to hear 2 challenges of the current congressional maps. The new case filed in a lower court is built on a different argument, and it comes as the 2026 midterm elections edge closer into focus, with the balance of power in the U.S. House of Representatives up for grabs.
John Johnson has been studying these cases. He's a research fellow in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School. John, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I think we need to start with some definitions so we're all on the same footing here. In gerrymandering, district boundaries are strategically manipulated to significantly influence election outcomes. And this latest case before Dane County Circuit Court alleges anti-competitive gerrymandering. What is that exactly?
Well, a partisan gerrymander is when you draw the lines to benefit one party over another. An anti-competitive gerrymander is when incumbents get together and draw the lines to benefit incumbents relative to challengers, and that it benefits incumbents of either or both parties.
Okay. And so the cases that went before the state Supreme Court, those were about partisan gerrymandering. Is that right?
One of them was. One of them was asking the court to find that partisan gerrymandering violates the state constitution, which is something no court has found before. And the other one was making extremely technical argument about population equality.
And the state's high court, though, they declined to hear those suits, but they didn't say why.
That's right. And that's common when a Supreme Court receives lots of petitions, and it's not unusual for them to deny them without comment.
You write how the 2011 maps for congressional districts were drawn up with input from all the state's representatives, Democrats and Republicans alike. How much input do incumbent lawmakers have on the redrawing of their own districts?
So this is an interesting point. In the state legislature, the state legislative districts are usually drawn in Wisconsin by state legislators themselves. So clearly a lot of input. The state legislature is also tasked with drawing the congressional district lines. There's no constitutional or statutory role for the Congress members themselves to draw those lines. But as it happens, for decades in Wisconsin, it had been the common practice for the state's congressional delegation to essentially get together and decide it's been described as a gentlemanly fashion, the boundaries that they wanted to have for their districts to rebalance the populations between them. And then they would give those districts that they wanted to the state legislature, and the state legislature would just sort of pass them as received.
Oh, okay. And so this latest argument is like, hey, that went too far, that they drew them in such a way that they are drawing out the competition and making sure that they retain the seat.
That's exactly the argument.
So, and also the state's current congressional maps, they were drawn by Governor Evers in that 21-2022 Congress, built on making as few changes as possible to the maps in place since 2011. You know, has this issue of anti-competitive gerrymander, has that come up before as a complaint?
In Wisconsin, no. I'm aware of no litigation that has ever made this specific argument before.
In 2023, a 2023 lawsuit overturned Wisconsin's local legislative maps, arguing, you know, parts of some districts weren't physically connected. In this argument before Dane County Circuit Court, is there any remnant of that type of argument here?
They point out that the grounds on which the current maps were drawn, that based on that least change principle, they point out that the least change principle has since been rejected by the court. That doesn't make these districts unconstitutional on its own. There wasn't a ruling that least change was sort of an invalidating argument, just that it wasn't the correct argument. So that's not a reason to reject the districts themselves.
Hmm. It's interesting because you asked the question outright in your most recent Substack post about these cases, is an anti-competitive gerrymander in violation of the state constitution? What do you think?
It's never been understood to be so before. So if your perspective is that it's wrong to come up with sort of new interpretations of what the Constitution means, then no, it is not. If your view of constitutional law is that the Constitution enshrines principles that sometimes aren't fully realized for decades after they're written, then maybe this makes more sense to you.
So it is a bit of an open question then.
Yeah, and it touches on a sort of fundamental way of viewing what constitutions mean.
We're talking about a new lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's congressional maps and the argument that hinges on it involving anti-competitive gerrymandering. John Johnson is a Marquette University Law School Research Fellow. John, the state Supreme Court, as we talked about recently, declined to hear two petitions involving the state's congressional maps. Does the argument in Wisconsin Business Leaders versus Wisconsin Elections Commission, this one before the circuit court, does that have more legal merit in rising up to the high court?
It might. So I think justices and judges are leery of partisan gerrymandering arguments because it implicitly asks the judges or justices to decide how many seats Democrats and Republicans should win, which is a very difficult question to answer and very much in the political thicket that the courts worry about. This case, on the other hand, sets up a different standard, a two-part standard for identifying a non-competitive gerrymander. They say, first, you need to show that there was intent by the incumbents to draw a map that would benefit them. And secondly, that you could draw a map that would have more competitive results, closer election results, while also satisfying all of the legal criteria for a map. And they say, if you can do those two things, you should take the map that is more competitive. And in a more competitive map, it's possible you could come up with a more lopsided result. You know, if a lot of seats were closely contested, you could imagine that in a year that was good for Republicans, they might win even more seats. And in a year that was good for Democrats, they might win even more seats. So you might see much wider swings back and forth from one election cycle to another. So it's a different approach to defining and identifying gerrymandering than the kind of partisan gerrymandering arguments that have been before the court in the past.
Right. Partisan gerrymandering has been much more front and center in this particular angle, anti-competitive gerrymander. That hasn't been the case. You know, the cases, they were brought forth by organizations based outside of Wisconsin, those other cases. Well, this one from the bipartisan Wisconsin Business Leaders for Democracy Coalition. Does it matter who is bringing these suits?
I think the court would say no. You know, they're interested in the arguments.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible, I think, that a law firm that is in Wisconsin and is working in the Wisconsin court system every day might have a little bit more insight into the kinds of arguments that are compelling to the justices. That's certainly possible. I will say that one of the law firms that's involved in this latest Wisconsin Business Leaders for Democracy suit is the same firm that brought the successful challenge to the state legislative maps on contiguity grounds.
Why does that matter? Why do you think?
They've won once before.
Okay. All right. So as we step back here, national politics followers, they suggest only Wisconsin's third district is a true toss-up in the 2026 midterms, which are coming closer each day with the maps as is. How could this latest suit potentially affect the balance of power in Congress in the 2026 midterms?
If the circuit court ruled in favor of it, I'm sure it would go to the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court ruled in favor of it and there were new maps drawn to try to be more competitive, I think we're probably looking at like what's currently the first district in southeastern Wisconsin probably being a little bit more competitive. But honestly, who knows? You know, when you go to the drawing board, you can do all kinds of things when you're drawing new maps.
If that timeline you just suggested would play out, would it hit even before the 2026 midterms? What about timeline?
Right. Yeah. So we ran into this in previous redistricting litigation in Wisconsin. The partisan primary for the congressional seats will be in August 2026.
Mm-hmm.
And so the filing deadline for candidates to get on the ballot for the August primary is, I believe, in April 2026. So any new boundaries would need to be in place in March at the latest.
Hmm. Do you expect more litigation to be filed over the state's congressional maps in coming months, or is this it?
We're running out of time, and I think, honestly, asking the courts to change the congressional districts midway through the decade is a really big ask. That's not something that courts like to do. It's something that the Supreme Court would look at with askance, the federal Supreme Court, I think. And so, I'd say it's still a long uphill road for this lawsuit and for any further lawsuits, even more so, just as the clock begins to run out.
Mm. I want to step back here, look across the country. President Trump said this week he's pushing Texas Republicans to redraw their state's congressional maps to create more House seats that favor the GOP. Might that type of pressure in another state affect these suits that are rising up here in Wisconsin?
I'm sure the judges would say no, but do we all read the same news? Yes.
Hmm. John, thank you so much for your time and analysis. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
John Johnson is a research fellow at the Marquette University Law School. His Substack, it's called Blue Book. It focuses on elections, housing, and demography in Milwaukee and beyond. He's been writing about the latest congressional map lawsuit. We've been talking about this latest lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's congressional maps ahead of the 2026 midterm elections.
Big computer game company layoffs hit home in Wisconsin. We'll dig into the industry and meet a Wisconsin company that's trying a different approach.
We're on that other end of things, challenging the ways the industry are operating, that we've seen some of the layoffs happen with some of these larger companies.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kitt.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Microsoft laid off some employees at the Middleton-based video game developer Raven Software as part of a round of layoffs affecting thousands of people nationwide. That's the latest chapter of layoffs in the turbulent video game industry.
Last year, the industry took in $187 billion in revenue, more than the film and music industries combined. But things have been tumultuous in recent years, with companies laying off more than 20,000 video game employees across 2023 and 2024.
Jason Schreier has been following these layoffs and how they affect Wisconsin companies like Raven. He's a reporter at Bloomberg, co-host of the Triple Click podcast, and author of three books on the video game business. His latest is titled Play Nice, The Rise, Fall, and Future of Blizzard Entertainment. Jason, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Let's start with some of the basics here. Now, people may be familiar with Raven Software, a Wisconsin-based software company founded as an independent company quite a while back. Well, now, hold on. Microsoft Xbox is laying off people, and that means Raven is seeing layoffs. Why is that? How did Raven end up in this big corporate umbrella?
How did Raven wind up becoming part of this organization? Well, that starts all the way back in 1997 when they were acquired by a video game publisher called Activision, back when they were making all sorts of games, including Hexen, and they worked on some Star Wars games. Eventually, they turned into a Call of Duty studio, like most of Activision's subsidiaries, because as Call of Duty grew more and more popular and lucrative, Activision wound up folding almost their entire organization into the Call of Duty machine. And then in 2022, when Microsoft announced that it was acquiring all of Activision Blizzard in a deal that ultimately closed at the end of 2023, Raven subsequently became part of Microsoft. And as a result, when Microsoft has its now biannual, if not more frequent, layoffs, Raven gets impacted as well.
You mentioned Microsoft somewhat regular layoffs, and then earlier this month, the gaming division, the Xbox division, with these layoffs that affect divisions, including Raven Software. What is driving these layoffs?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of factors. The biggest one I would say is that, as I mentioned, Microsoft purchased Activision in a deal that closed at the end of 2023. That was a deal for a whopping $69 billion. And before that deal, Xbox, it was a profitable organization, but it was also able to kind of operate not under the radar per se, but certainly had a little bit more leeway in the Microsoft fold. But after that deal, after Microsoft's top executives, Satya Nadella, the CEO, Amy Hood, the CFO, after they looked over and said, hey, we just spent $69 billion on a video game company, we better start seeing some returns pretty quickly. And so that was when the P&Ls needed to be tightened up and the layoffs started to happen. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of kind of industry shaking events surrounding the tech industry and the entertainment industry. In gaming, growth has really plateaued in a lot of areas of the sector over the last couple of years. And obviously the introduction of AI as a large part of Microsoft's kind of future business model has also played a role in restructuring and cutting costs in other areas of the business. So it's really this confluence of all these different factors.
Do we know how many jobs are being lost at a division like Raven Software?
We do. It's last I heard, it's a small amount. I believe it was less than 20 is what I heard. So small comparative to the rest of what happened at Microsoft. But really, a lot of people who work at Raven, who work elsewhere, who have watched what happened, are looking over at that and saying, why is that happening when Call of Duty remains the most profitable or one of the most profitable video game franchises on the planet? The most recent Call of Duty was breaking records. There's new one coming this fall, as always. This is not a series that is shrinking or failing to produce profits. So it definitely seems a little bit questionable that even the Call of Duty studios, as opposed to maybe the subsidiaries of Microsoft that haven't produced quite as much, that even these Call of Duty studios are getting hit. But yes, the number was less than 20 is what I have heard at Raven.
Jason, I think maybe once upon a time, somebody gets laid off in the video game industry. Well, bummer, but hey, you just go work for another studio, not the end of the world. I don't know if that was ever exactly true. Is that true now, though? Or are we seeing a contraction in this industry where that layoff might be a longer-term problem for the people laid off?
Definitely a longer-term problem. What happened was in 2020, when everybody was stuck at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, we watched video game profits go through the roof. We saw a lot of people who had nothing else to do but buy video games, go ahead and buy video games. And as a result, a lot of these game companies expanded. They wanted to be able to handle that growth. Maybe they thought it would last forever. Who knows? And at the same time, we also saw interest rates getting really, really low. So it was very easy for a lot of these companies, especially the kind of the venture capital backed companies, to make big hiring waves and spend a lot of money. A couple of years later, as of course was inevitable, when the world went back to normal and we were all able to leave the house again, the numbers started to shrink and the growth did not last. They weren't seeing the same kind of returns that they saw in 2020. And as a result, what we've seen is a lengthy correction period in which a lot of people are losing their jobs. But unlike periods of correction in the past, we now have a much bigger talent pool of people who are looking for work because the games industry expanded so much in 2020. So suddenly you have a lot more people competing over the same jobs. I've heard all sorts of horror stories about junior roles just getting filled by people with 10, 15, 20 years of experience, whereas people who are just trying to enter the video game industry or only have a couple of years behind their belt are just unable to find any work. dark. It's really grim, and I think a lot of people are really struggling to find new work if they've been caught up in one of the layoffs that hit recently. And yes, to your point, that is actually a pretty big difference from previous kind of corrections in the video game industry. I remember a big one, or a sizable one, in about 2008, 2009, 2010, that period after the housing crisis and kind of a big recessionary period for the U.S., there was definitely some periods of layoffs, but I think it was a little bit easier back then to bounce back and find another games industry job than it is today.
Jason, what in your reporting now is the big open question for these studios that work for the bigger companies, studios like Raven, and what comes next?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of questions. The biggest one I would say is, will this industry return to significant growth, or is it mature? And a lot of people, especially surrounding the console industry, so this world of, let's call it 100, 150 million people, players who buy PlayStations and Xboxes or PCs, and they're playing games like Call of Duty and Assassin's Creed and others. Call of Duty might actually be in kind of its own category these days because it's so big, but let's put that aside. And the big question is, like, is that market going to grow, or have consoles pretty much plateaued? And if they plateaued, what does that mean for the larger gaming market and its ability to keep, like, witnessing the double-digit growth that it had seen before? And then the kind of the supplemental question to that is, can the costs of video game productions keep going up? And is that sustainable? Or is there a way to put a cap on those costs? Because one of the kind of quagmires of the video game industry right now is that video game budgets have gone up and up and up. These productions now take games that used to take 2-3 years now take 5-7 years to make, which is essentially doubling their production costs. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars on these games, on each one of these games. And so that means their returns are lower. They need to sell many, many more copies before they turn a profit. And that is dangerous for a lot of different reasons. And so combination of a market plateauing and costs going up is just going to lead to more contraction and more job cuts unless something drastic happens, unless some big changes are made. So those are the two big factors that I think a lot of people are keeping an eye on. Is the market going to return to significant growth, or is it kind of, it is where it is? And is there a way to get the costs of these productions and the length of time that these games take to make, is there a way to get those down?
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Jason Schreier is a reporter at Bloomberg, co-host of the Triple Click podcast, and the author of three books on the video game industry. For a local perspective, let's bring in Ben Qualo. He's the founder and CEO of Midwest Games, based in Green Bay. Ben, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's great to be here.
Well, our starting point, as we've just heard, our conversation about Raven Software. Now, they're a Wisconsin-based software company that's a part of, obviously, a much bigger organization. Can you give us a sense of where Midwest Games is, a very different kind of company, as I understand it, not part of a big international conglomerate?
Yeah, you know, we are a startup, so we're pretty young. We're a bit different. And part of our thesis is that we're kind of challenging some of the norms in the industry. So we're on the whole other end of the spectrum in comparison to someone like Raven, who's been around for 35 years, owned by Activision acquired by Microsoft, and then all these layoffs. So we're on that other end of things that is looking at kind of challenging the ways the industry are operating, that we've seen some of the layoffs happen with some of these larger companies.
And one of those ways you're challenging that is your location. I think probably a lot of people in the computer game world might think, starting up in Green Bay, why start up in Green Bay?
Well, we saw an opportunity. There's a gap. And we quite literally put a map and showed where games publishers are located in the U.S., and there's a giant gap in the middle of the country. And so we saw an opportunity with the fact that Titletown Tech was put together by a combination of the Green Bay Packers and Microsoft coming together to create a venture firm, and an ability to partner with somebody like that and bring more to the Midwest. But what we're looking to do is provide the support services that help enable game developers to have better success in market. And we saw Green Bay and really Wisconsin as a whole as a real opportunity, both from a cost perspective. It's vastly cheaper than where 62% of the industry is, which is California, Washington, and Texas. And we also saw an opportunity with talent. There's an incredible amount of talent that is in Wisconsin, from Wisconsin. And if we can create pathways back, we have a burgeoning video game development and industry right here in the state of Wisconsin.
I want to talk about your strategy there at Midwest Games. One way to be a video game company is to have, you know, a budget in the hundreds of millions of dollars and hope you're going to come up with the next big hit. A lot of the games I like are one or two people, the Dwarf Fortresses and Balatros and Stardew Valleys, you know, one person and eventually finding that audience. What do you do at Midwest Games?
So what we do is, as a publisher, we help find game developers, you know, some of the ones that you just talked about. You know, there's even a great example right near us in Northern Illinois, a game called Animal Well that was put out. And, you know, overnight, I think the first weekend they made like $6 million, a single person studio, worked in the game for 8 years. And so we help find those folks and then give them the resources to come to market, to have the best chance. You know, a lot of folks don't realize how many games come out every year on Steam alone, which Steam is, you know, the largest PC platform in the world. You had 19,000 games that came out last year. We expect 25,000 to come out this year. So publishing services and the ability to provide marketing, production support, strategy and go to market, and developer services are so key to a game developer succeeding and standing out when there's 25,000 other games that you're competing with, you know, 60 plus games a day that are coming out. And so it's so key that you have these services, and that's why I think it's important that we have my company and more as part of the ecosystem we're trying to build here.
What kind of things are you doing to advocate and to get that critical mass of video game production here in the state?
So I look at it as two key items. One is driving awareness for what actually already exists. A lot of folks don't realize Dungeons and Dragons came from Wisconsin, or that Raven that works on Call of Duty is in Wisconsin, or you know, games like Apex Legends or PUBG or Disney Heroes was created by a game studio that's a homegrown studio called Purblue. And so driving awareness is a big key so that people realize this is happening here. This isn't something that is happening somewhere else. It is right in our backyard. And then the second piece being networking. We need folks to connect more. And I think that's been one of the larger struggles in this region, is getting events and moments for people to come together, meet each other, get to know each other, and then eventually create the pathways towards maybe working together or collaborating together across companies. That is what happens a ton in California, and that's why California is the way it is in San Francisco and LA. And we need more of those collaboration moments. So as the WGA, we look to try to enable those via different socials that we do monthly throughout the state, or MDev, which happens in November. It's November 7th and 8th this year. The event has grown, doubled in size the last 2 years in a row. We've now extended the event to be a two-day event, and now it's the largest games industry-focused event in the entire Midwest, and really the middle of the entire country. And so we have a fortunate platform that the WGA is helping to shepherd and grow.
At the state level, there's been proposed legislation that would create a tax credit for video game producers. One of the ideas on the table, 30% of the wages paid to Wisconsin employees, that tax credit. Is that something you have your eye on? Do you think that could help accomplish what you're looking to do?
Yes. This is a huge moment for the games industry in Wisconsin. If this tax incentive goes through, I know companies that are based in Texas, California, and Washington that will move either segments of their company or build brand new segments of their company in Wisconsin. So it is a really interesting moment for this to be coming to fruition. And I help testify on behalf of what is happening in the industry here and all the momentum that we have. But we're in a unique moment post-COVID where suddenly these companies, to the point of like Raven having layoffs, a lot of other layoffs, they're all looking to be more efficient in how they operate and look at new places because of where they're currently located. And Wisconsin has become that centerpiece that if this tax legislation goes through, we will become a mega hub globally for video games, which is a very fortunate seat to sit in. And that's why I've been working, you know, overtime to really make sure that folks realize the opportunity that we have in front of us right now.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Qualo is founder and CEO of Midwest Games, a video game publisher based in Green Bay. Earlier, we spoke with Jason Schreier, a reporter at Bloomberg, about layoffs by Microsoft and Xbox that affected Raven Software, a company here in Wisconsin. Microsoft did not reply to our request for a comment or interview. You can reply, though, if you work in the video game industry or would like to do that here in Wisconsin. Do you see a prospect to do that? Would you like to see more video game production happening here in the state? Do you like the idea of state incentives to do so? Have you gone through one of the video game production programs at UW campuses like UW-Stout, Whitewater, or Green Bay? Love to hear your perspective. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Up next, 10 years after the Supreme Court allowed same-sex marriage, a major Christian denomination works to overturn it. Two gay Wisconsin pastors shared their stories.
And I thought, wow, there is this movement I was previously unaware of folks within denominations fighting for equality, just to be recognized as a human being.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Late last month, people across the nation marked the 10-year anniversary of Obergefell versus Hodges. That's the U.S. Supreme Court case that affirmed marriage equality for all, including same-sex couples.
Also last month, the National Southern Baptist Church, the nation's largest Protestant denomination, formalized efforts to reverse that U.S. Supreme Court case and effectively ban same-sex marriage.
Although that effort could take years, the news has sent shockwaves through Wisconsin's religious community.
Two openly gay Wisconsin clergy join us now to share their stories and their thoughts on last month's news. Reverend Tim Schaefer has served as the pastor of First Baptist Church in Madison since 2020 and is the first openly gay pastor to do so. He co-hosts the Christian and Name Only podcast. And Reverend Heather Urien-Keck is a pastor serving two congregations, Calvary Lutheran Church in Two Rivers and St. Paul Lutheran in Manitowoc. Reverend Urien-Keck, thanks for joining us.
I am very glad to be here. Thank you for asking me.
And Reverend Schaefer, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Now, Tim, take us back. It's been just over 10 years since the Supreme Court decision that made a same-sex marriage legal across the country. Can you take us back to your vantage point, your reaction to that decision?
Yeah, I have to say that my spouse and I were married before that decision in a state where it was legal. We actually were married in California. And we did that strategically. My family was living there at the time, and we traveled to a state and kind of chose that based on where we could legally get married. And the Obergefell decision, we just celebrated that because we knew that was a guarantee that not only the federal government would recognize our marriage and that we would get all the benefits that come with marriage, but that also it freed us up to move, you know, from state to state and have that guarantee of our marriage being recognized, of our relationship being recognized. that was a huge, huge, huge moment.
And Heather, same question for you. Can you take us back to what that meant just over 10 years ago for you?
It was pretty much the same thing. We had been married prior to that also, and we had to travel to a state that we could get married in because we were living in a state that it wasn't recognized. And then having that, finally having that federal recognition that allowed us the freedom to have recognition no matter where we lived was a freedom and just a big shrug of relief that we would be free and recognized and honored wherever we lived was just tremendous.
I want to ask each of you what this issue has looked like in your own congregations. Obviously not universal agreement among Christians, among denominations. This time, Heather, Reverend Uriankek, let's start with you. You're at Lutheran congregations in Two Rivers and Manitowoc. How do people talk about this? Do people talk about this?
I'm an ELCA congregation, and the ELCA says on paper that we openly accept and we openly call, but there is a complete variance from congregation to congregation about their willingness to talk about it and their willingness to accept it. I am presently at a congregation that stepped up and agreed to call an openly gay pastor. But I can tell you that in my call process that I was turned down by two congregations because of my relationship. They were not ready, willing, or able to accept a pastor that was anything other than straight. So there is just so much variety in that response.
And Tim, you're at the First Baptist Church in Madison. How, to what extent is same-sex marriage a topic of conversation?
I will say it is not so much anymore, aside from folks sort of lamenting that this isn't a policy that all Baptist churches embrace. So the history of my congregation is they had a big discussion about this when they made the decision to formally become welcoming and affirming in 1994. So really one of the earliest congregations, even in Madison, but certainly among the first Baptist churches in the country to become open and affirming. And so they have wrestled with that kind of well in their past, and that's not an issue anymore. And the one thing I will say about Baptists, which is interesting, and it may be a little bit different, you know, among other denominations, is that we have what we call a congregational polity, which means that the congregations get to make decisions about how they do ministry. That's rooted really deeply in the sort of historic Baptist tradition of these four freedoms. One of those is church freedom, that we have that autonomy to do ministry the way we see fit. Bible freedom, we get to interpret scripture the way that, you know, we see fit as individuals, but also as congregations. And so these are the kinds of things, you know, wrestling with what this says, what scripture says about these relationships and the sanctity of marriage is something that my congregation did. They did that work a long time ago.
Now, another Baptist denomination, maybe the best known in the country, the Southern Baptist denomination, voted to say, hey, we are going to actively seek to overturn this Obergefell decision from 10 years ago and make it possible then for states to make same-sex marriage illegal. Complicated feelings, maybe, seeing this active effort from a major denomination within that Baptist umbrella.
Yes. No, that's absolutely true. My congregation is primarily American Baptist, and the American Baptist Churches USA and the Southern Baptist Convention have a long history. They split over the issue of slavery, which many denominations did. But I will say that more and more the Southern Baptist Convention seems to be eroding some of those four foundational freedoms that Baptists, the first Baptists in America, really championed. And the way that that's sort of playing out now is that the denomination is making decisions about how scripture should be interpreted on all sorts of issues, including gay marriage, but all sorts of hot button issues, and also how their churches ought to do ministry. And so they don't, you know, Southern Baptist churches really don't have that freedom anymore to do ministry in a way that's authentic to them and meaningful for their context. And sadly, Southern Baptists tend to be the loudest voices in the room. And so we get a lot of people who come and visit us sort of hesitantly for the first time. And all they know about Baptists is what they hear from the Southern Baptist Convention. And so I appreciate you in the intro mentioning that that among Christian denominations and even within Christian denominations, there is a lot of diversity. And there is among American Baptists. I will say the American Baptists in Wisconsin, we First Baptist out of 50 some odd congregations are the only open and affirming congregation formally. I am the only openly queer pastor in any church in a Baptist church in Wisconsin. If you go to other areas like the Chicago metro area or the West Coast or the Northeast, you have a lot more openness. And so there's a huge range.
And Heather, the same story is there for the broad umbrella of what we might call Lutheranism, Lutheran churches. You are in the ELCA, sometimes I think thought of as one of the more liberal denominations in Christianity in the U.S. Lutheranism includes some of the most conservative, I think, denominations or sub-denominations in the U.S. Can you talk about the spectrum of attitudes towards same-sex marriage within the Lutheran faith?
There's everything from it's probably sentiment close to the Southern Baptist beliefs to everything welcome, open, and affirming. Definitely, if you step out of the ELCA and you go to the Missouri Synod or the Wells, it definitely falls along the lines of the more conservative line. It is not openly accepted. It's not even, there is just no belief that there is a place in the church for gay marriage or the LGBTQI community. There is just the whole diversity, like in the Baptist faith, in the Lutheran, in the bigger, broader Lutheran umbrella.
We are looking at the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively legalized same-sex marriage in all states in the United States. And challenges to that going on, we've got two openly gay clergy from Wisconsin with us, Reverend Heather Urien-Keck with the Calvary Lutheran Church in Two Rivers and St. Paul Lutheran in Manitowoc, Reverend Tim Schaefer, pastor of First Baptist Church in Madison. I want to hear some of your personal stories. And Tim, let's start with you. Your story was in the news. You were national news in some ways. And your father, can you take us back to your marriage and the decision your father made and the backlash to that?
Sure. I will say this was my first marriage since divorced and remarried. But my dad performed the ceremony. We were living at the time in Boston. And Massachusetts was, you know, among the first states, or maybe the first state that legalized gay marriage. And shortly thereafter, we were married. It was very important to have this be a family affair. It wasn't actually, a ceremony wasn't even in a church. It was in a restaurant, family only. And so my dad traveled up. He was at the time serving as a United Methodist pastor in kind of a rural Pennsylvania congregation. And he performed the ceremony. His signature, of course, then was on our wedding certificate. And due to whatever struggles were happening within his congregation, somebody decided that the best way to embarrass him or to perhaps get him out of that congregation was to look up this marriage certificate with his signature on it, because that act at the time violated the United Methodist Church's Book of Discipline. And so a complaint was filed. They were not able to resolve that. It ended up in a trial, and he was convicted of performing my marriage and subsequently defrocked, meaning his credentials were stripped away, and he was ousted from his, not just his congregation, but from their conference. Fortunately, through some sort of legal maneuvering, because believe it or not, churches, denominations, they have these legal systems, courts, very much structured after the American court system, which I find very odd. But in any case, on a technicality, maybe a year later or so, he was reinstated and then did ministry in California. But that was, I will say, the pain of having to go through this very public spectacle of a trial and being questioned. And I was one of those, you know, quote-unquote witnesses in this trial and being asked very personal questions. It was hard on my family. It was a really painful event.
So how do you go from that to, yeah, I'm going to answer the call and become a pastor?
I will tell you that when I was younger, I watched my dad and I wanted to be a pastor. And because I did not see a lot of openly queer clergy like myself that I could identify with that were sort of role models, I convinced myself it was not possible and I kind of went a different path. I will say the moment of this trial, actually reignited that calling to ministry. And the reason was, yes, the church was putting my dad on trial, but what happened was hundreds of supporters came to support my family and support my dad to be present in this hearing, because it's an open hearing, anybody can attend. So many people that the room was filled to capacity, and there were still many people outside of the building holding signs and chanting and praying and singing. And I thought, wow, there is this movement I was previously unaware of folks within denominations fighting for equality, just to be recognized as a human being. And that I wanted to be a part of that. And so that really reignited my calling into the ministry.
And Heather, can you take us through your story? I understand feeling like denominations did not accept you, and then to the point where you took this call.
I had grown up at the church, grew up in the Lutheran church before the EALC formed. And then when I came out in the early 90s, was living in the lower Midwest in the time of the Westboro Baptist Church and its prevalence of hate and protesting at gay funerals and protesting in street corners and just this prominent message of hate and fear-mongering around just being in the LGBTQI community. And so I walked away from the church because I didn't feel that there was any other church saying anything about how there was a place in the church for me as a lesbian. And it was at least 15, 20 years before I could walk back into church and feel that there was a place. I never walked away from God, but I walked away from church. And when I walked back in, it was because there was a rainbow sticker on somebody's bumper in the car in the parking lot. And then what got ignited in me was that I knew there was a whole generation of people my age that had been hurt and injured by the church. And people, the church is not saying anything that there was a place for beloved creations of God like myself. And so that ignited my call to come back to the church and be that voice for the people who had been hurt by the church and to bring them back, or at least to let them know that they're still loved, even if they can't believe in the church.
I'll leave it there. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Reverend Heather Urienkek is a pastor serving two congregations, Calvary Lutheran Church in Two Rivers and St. Paul Lutheran in Manitowoc. And Reverend Tim Schaefer has served as the pastor of First Baptist Church in Madison since 2020. He's the first openly gay pastor to do so. He co-hosts the Christian in Name Only podcast. But talk about their experiences on the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage earlier this summer.
A few months ago, we shared the work of Karen Wynn Fonstad, the Oshkosh cartographer who mapped Middle Earth. That's a setting for the Lord of the Rings books and movies.
I went behind the scenes with Karen's son, Mark, who was scanning a lot of her maps in hopes of creating an archive. I saw a bunch of the original maps spread out at the UW-Madison Map Library. Just one problem. I got to see him. Hardly anybody else did.
But that's going to change. Mark emailed us since the interview aired and our web article went up. A lot of people asked the map library if they could see the maps as well. And now they can. UW-Madison will hold an exhibit. It's called Fantastic Worlds, our cartographic exploration of the works of fantasy mapmaker Karen Wynn Fonstad.
Kicks off Monday at UW-Madison's Map Library in the Science Hall building, runs through August 1st. If you check it out, or if you have a story to share about Fonstad and her Atlas of Middle Earth, let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Trevor Hook, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is WPR News.